Well, we've been taking a journey for the since the beginning of 2023 through the Bible, as most of you know by now. And we have made it. We started with the Old Testament because that came first. And we have made it through the kingdom of Israel, the divided kingdom. Both kingdoms were conquered. We saw that just recently. And we have just a little bit more to go after today. We're going to finish the story we started last week. And then over the next few weeks, we have stories like Daniel, who are pretty interesting, Esther, Ezra and Nehemiah. And then we're pretty much done. We're going to be ready before the holidays get here. We'll have a little bit of a gap, and we're going to get into the story of Jesus. And the New Testament, the Christian story, is coming soon. But we've been journeying through, and last week we saw the destruction of Jerusalem, and a prophet named Jeremiah, who had a very thankless job during that time. He told the people, you know, here's what we should do. No one listened to him. They were unnecessarily pulverized by Babylon. We saw the king captured and just punished severely. We see the city burned down. The walls are broken down. Jerusalem is now a pile of rubble. And people who were hauled away into captivity 11 years earlier are now joined by a few others who survived. Many people were killed in the final brutal siege. Some were left behind as the poorest of the land. Others were taken into captivity to join the others in Babylon. But Jerusalem is destroyed. And Jeremiah is one of the people who was in prison there because of the message he preached. But the Babylonians took him into captivity initially. However, as we saw at the very end of last week, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon decides to set Jeremiah free. And that's where we start our story today. We're going to finish Jeremiah and look at an extra book that he wrote, and then we'll conclude this section of the story. Jeremiah 40, verse number 2 says, "The captain of the guard called for Jeremiah and said, 'The Lord your God has brought this disaster on this land, just as he said he would. For these people have sinned against the Lord and disobeyed him. That's why it happened.'" Now, he's not telling Jeremiah something that Jeremiah has not already said many times. What he's saying to Jeremiah here is, hey, we've heard your message. Perhaps the people of your own country rejected your message. They rejected your advice. But people who left and came to us and defected to us told us that you were trying to be the voice of reason to unreasonable people. And they didn't, your own people didn't respect it. They ignored you. They beat you. They imprisoned you. But we heard about it, and we appreciate the things you were saying. And so he said, "But I am going to take off your chains and let you go." That's very unusual. Babylon was not known to just let people go in captivity. But Jeremiah, they appreciated him, and they said, "We're going to let you go. If you want to come with me," he said, "to Babylon, you are welcome. I will see that you are well cared for. But if you don't want to come, you may stay here. The whole land is before you. Go wherever you like. If you decide to stay, then return to Gedaliah." We met him 2 weeks ago. "Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, grandson of Shaphan. He has been appointed as governor of Judah by the king of Babylon. Stay there with the people that he rules. But again, it's up to you. Go wherever you like." So Jeremiah is given options. They're like, "We're setting you free. And if you come with us, we'll treat you well." Jeremiah is getting better treatment from the bad guys. You know, he's in his own country, and the people are like, his own people are like, "We don't like your message. We don't like what your advice about what's best for the best policy for our nation, so we're going to mistreat you and think the worst of you and imprison you," right? And the Babylonians, they're the foreigners, they're the bad guys. And yet he finds that his own people, God's people, treat him terrible. And these people that he was told were bad were so good to him. You ever had that moment in life where you see people who are supposed to be there for you, supposed to be the good ones, weren't, and other people who you thought weren't, surprisingly were, and the dissonance that creates in your head, like, what in the world, you know? And Jeremiah is experiencing this goodness, this kindness from Babylon. Then it says, verse 5, "Then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, gave Jeremiah some food and money and let him go." That's a big deal because there was a famine because of the siege on Jerusalem. So food was a premium. He's like, "Here's some food," like Instacart delivery to your doorstep, you know. "You're going to be all set, and we're going to Venmo you some cash. You're going to be all set. Jeremiah, go your merry way." So Jeremiah returned, verse 6, to Gedaliah, son of Ahikam at Mizpah, and he lived in Judah with a few who were still left in the land. Interesting thing here. Jeremiah could have gone to Babylon, but he chose to stay there. I don't understand him. And I do, but I don't. Because, you know, way back when he was, before Jerusalem was destroyed, he kept telling people, go to Babylon, surrender. The king's going to get us all wrecked. Go save yourselves now. But he didn't do it. Would have been better off than to stay behind and get treated the way he was treated in last week's story. Why did he not take the easy path out? But Jeremiah felt like God has given me a calling, and it was not to walk the easy path. God's calling on my life is to do the hard thing, so I'm going to stay here and let others go and answer God's call on my life. Well, now he's being told, come to Babylon. The city's destroyed. We'll take care of you. You'll be a celebrity there. And Jeremiah says, no, I'm going to stay with in the wreck of a city, in the wreck of an area, with people who don't even like me most of the time and probably still won't. Why? Jeremiah's like, there's eternity to take it easy. I've been given a job and a purpose to fulfill. And I'm going to live my life doing the hard thing to serve my Lord. And so I really admire, I've said all along, Jeremiah is one of the most underrated prophets in the scriptures, because he has a hard road, but he does such a good job of trusting God and doing the hard thing. So he stays behind. Well, remember, Gedaliah is the governor that Babylon has appointed to keep the people together. Now, the people of Judah, there ain't many left. They've either been carried into captivity at some point over the last 11 or 12 years, or they've been killed, or whatever. Those who survived or hid or escaped, or maybe they were so remote that they were overlooked, they made their way to Jerusalem to see the rubble of their capital city and to figure out what to do next. And there were some men amongst them, some soldiers who had survived, and they kind of formed a little ragtag army. They appointed some commanders amongst the soldiers that were left to guard the people that were left, who gathered to Gedaliah for direction as he was the appointed authority over their pulverized area by Babylon. And so in chapter 40 and verse 9, Gedaliah vowed to them that the Babylonians meant them no harm, or no more harm, I guess. He says, don't be afraid to serve them. Live in the land and serve the king of Babylon, and all will go well for you, he promised. Which Jeremiah's like, that's what I've been saying. No one listened to me, you know. So he says, just cooperate. It'll be fine. This is inevitable. Then he said in verse 10, as for me, I will stay at Mizpah, because I can't stay at Jerusalem because it's a pile of rubble. I will stay at Mizpah to represent you before the Babylonians who come to meet us. So you settle in the towns you've taken and live off the land. Harvest the grapes and the summer fruits and the olives and store them away. Well, that should have been the end of that. They should have just cooperated, but do you think these folks just cooperate? Do you think this goes well here? Anyone want to guess? But anyhow, so sure enough, it says in verse 13, that soon after this, Johanan and the other military leaders came to Gedaliah at Mizpah, and they said to him, did you know that Baalis, king of Ammon, has sent Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, to assassinate you? They're like, you know, there's this guy named Ishmael. He's actually a royal descendant of the royal family of Judah, of David's lineage. But he apparently got away a long time ago, defected to Ammon, survived the carnage. He's coming back to this area to assassinate you as a mercenary hire of the king of Ammon. I don't know why the king of Ammon wanted Gedaliah dead. Maybe he hated Babylon. Maybe he was just being that way. But he sends Gedaliah to do the work so he has plausible deniability. Or not Gedaliah, he sends Ishmael to do the dirty work, to kill Gedaliah. And then Johanan and the other military leaders say, hey, this guy's coming to kill you. We know. Are you aware of this? But Gedaliah refused to believe them. Later, verse 15, later Johanan had a private conference with Gedaliah, and he volunteered to kill Ishmael secretly. He's like, look, why should we let him come and murder you? Johanan asked, what will happen then to the Judeans who have returned? Why should the few of us who are still left be scattered and lost? Let me just kill him. You don't have to do anything about it. That way you'll live and we'll all be safer because you're the governor the king of Babylon appointed. For our sake and yours, let me kill Ishmael. But Gedaliah said to Johanan, I forbid you to do any such thing. for you are lying about Ishmael. Like, I know Ishmael. Yeah, he may not agree on all the policies, but he wouldn't do that, you know, and we'll talk it out. It's going to be fine. Okay. Chapter 41, verse 1 says, but in mid-autumn of that year, Ishmael, who was a member of the royal family and had been one of the king's high officials, went to Mizpah with 10 men to meet Gedaliah. You think Gedaliah would be like, oh, here's the threat. Should I be on guard? But instead, Gedaliah's like, hey, let's sit down and have some Chipotle, you know? Let's have a big meal together and let's just talk. And it says, while they were eating together, Ishmael and his 10 men suddenly jumped up, drew their swords, and sure enough, they killed Gedaliah, whom the king of Babylon had appointed governor. Ishmael also killed all the Judeans and Babylonian soldiers who were with Gedaliah at Mizpah. Whoops, that's not good. Now, without reading the whole story, what he does is he takes the bodies out back to a ravine or a pit, and he throws all these bodies. He saves some people behind that he wants to keep as prisoner, some soldiers, some of the royal family's young daughters, people he wants to traffic back to Ammon with him. He wants to bring them back as property because he's going to get paid for his assassination work, plus keep some people as his property, plus sell the rest, traffic the rest for more money. So he's getting ready to do this thing. But the ones he kills, he throws into this ravine, this pit, like a genocide. It's terrible. Around that same time, 80 other people show up to Mizpah to meet the governor. And Ishmael's like, oh, he's back here. Come back here. And he brings them to the pit. They're horrified. He kills all of them too, like all except 10 of them, who basically say, please, if you let us live, we have secret treasure hidden through the captivity. We'll pay you off to let us live. Okay, fine. Bring me back the goods. Everyone else gets killed and tossed into the pit. Just a terrible butchery. And then Gedaliah brings all his treasure, his people, back to Ammon to get his loot and his payment. In chapter 41, verse 11, it says, but when Johanan, son of Kareah, and the other military leaders heard about Ishmael's crimes, they took all of their men and set out to stop him. They caught up with him at the large pool near Gibeon. Apparently, that's an important landmark. I don't know if that means anything to us, but maybe for the early readers back then, they'd be like, oh, I know where that's at, the large pool by Gibeon, right, absolutely. So anyhow, they caught him there. The people Ishmael captured shouted for joy when they saw Johanan and the other military leaders. Hey, we're going to be set free. And all the captives from Mizpah escaped and began to help Johanan. But meanwhile, Ishmael and 8 of his men escaped from Johanan into the land of Ammon. So he gets away. He loses all of his loot, all of his trafficking loot. But he does escape. He does get paid eventually, no doubt, for killing Gedaliah. He shouldn't get away with it, but that's just how life goes sometimes. I mean, we have to believe in the long run, things catch up with people, right? He gets away. Then Johanan and the other military leaders took all the people they had rescued in Gibeon, the soldiers, women, children, and court officials whom Ishmael had captured after he killed Gedaliah. He takes all the people, and it says they took them all to the village of Geruth Kimham near Bethlehem. Bethlehem's an important landmark in the Old Testament story. It's the town that David was from. It's the town that Jesus Christ would be born in. We'll be there before the year's over. But they go back to Bethlehem area where they prepared to leave for Egypt. Now, why will they go to Egypt? Here's why. They were afraid of what the Babylonians would do when they heard that Ishmael, who was one of their own originally, had killed Gedaliah, the governor appointed by the Babylonian king. They're like, man, Babylon is tired of our rebellion. They're going to come down and crush all of us because Gedaliah was executed. Let's get out of here and go to Egypt. We don't want to go to Egypt. You know, we got enemies. Some of our folks are in captivity in Babylon to the east. Now we're gonna go west, young man. We're gonna go to Egypt and hide out there because we're afraid of the king of Babylon. So they pack up their bags and get ready to go. But something interesting happens. I want us to see it together. Jeremiah 42, beginning with verse 1. Then all the military leaders, including Johanan and Jezaniah, and all the people, from the least to the greatest, approached Jeremiah the prophet. This is interesting. They approached Jeremiah. Now, why? He's been almost forgotten for the last few minutes here. They approached him and they said, please pray to the Lord your God for us. Notice they say the Lord your God. Please pray to the Lord your God for us. As you can see, we are only a tiny remnant compared to what we were before. Pray that the Lord your God will show us what to do and where to go. That's pretty cool. They're going to Jeremiah saying, hey, you know, would you pray for us? We need direction. Verse 4, all right, Jeremiah replied, I will pray to the Lord your God. See what he does there? He's not just my God, he's your God, he's everyone's God. I'll pray to the Lord your God, as you have asked, and I will tell you everything he says. I will hide nothing from you. Now look what they say, verse 5. Then they said to Jeremiah, may the Lord your God be a faithful witness against us if we refuse to obey whatever he tells us to do. Whether we like it or not, we will obey the Lord our God, to whom we are sending you with our plea. For if we obey him, everything will turn out well for us. I mean, Jeremiah's got to be like, pinch me, somebody. Is this really the response I'm getting from the people? Like, no one's ever listened to Jeremiah. Like, ah, oh, you're an idiot, you know? So they'd be like, oh, no. Whatever God tells you that we should do, Jeremiah, we will listen because we've learned it turns out best for us when we listen to God, so we'll listen to you whether we like it or not. We think we know what we ought to do, but whatever God says is what we're going to do. And Jeremiah's like, whoa, okay. A new day is dawning, right? So he goes to pray, but the problem is he does not get an answer to his prayer right away. It takes like a week and a half. You ever have that moment where you're seeking God's answer? You want to know now, like right now, and it seems like it takes a while to sort it out. So a week and a half passes, and guess what happens with every passing day? All the people who are waiting for Jeremiah to come back and tell them, they're panicking. They're like, man, by now the king of Babylon's heard what we've done. He's going to come and crush us. We got to get out of here. And they work themselves up into a frenzy. They convinced each other that they can't wait any longer. Let's go to Egypt. And right about that time, the bags are packed. The Uber was called. And about that time, Jeremiah comes back with his answer. Verse 7, 10 days later, the Lord gave Jeremiah his reply to Jeremiah. So he called for Johanan and the other military leaders and for all the people, from the least to the greatest. And he said to them, you sent me to the Lord, the God of Israel, with your request. This is his reply. Stay here in this land. If you do, I will build you up and not tear you down. I will plant you and not uproot you, for I am sorry about all the punishment that I had to bring upon you. Do not fear the king of Babylon anymore, says the Lord, for I am with you and will save you and rescue you from his power. I will be merciful to you by making him kind, so he will let you stay here in your land. I know you're afraid and you want to run, but stay here. I'll work it out. You won't get blamed. Stay in your land. The people are like, are you kidding me? The shuttle bus is already here. Like, we're not sticking around. We've already convinced ourselves that's a terrible idea. So Jeremiah continues in verse 19. He says, listen, you remnant of Judah, the Lord has told you, do not go to Egypt. Don't forget this warning I have given you today. For you were not being honest when you sent me to pray to the Lord your God for you. You said, just tell us what the Lord our God says and we will do it. And I've told you exactly what he said. But you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God any better now than you have in the past. Ouch, Jeremiah. Harsh. Like, really? You're not going to even believe these people? Like, yeah, you're not going to listen. I know you. Jeremiah, they said they would listen to you. Jeremiah, are you having, like, trauma from the past when people didn't listen to you? Is this like PTSD and you're convinced they won't listen to you? They said they would, but Jeremiah's like, nope, you've already got your minds made up. And so he says, so you can be sure that you will die from war, from famine and disease in Egypt, where you insist on going. You're going to run from here to Egypt for safekeeping, and you're going to find out that the problems you're running from will follow you there. You've just been better off trusting God instead of trusting yourself. But by all means, do your own thing. Well, sure enough, chapter 43, verse 1, when Jeremiah had finished giving this message from the Lord their God to all the people, Azariah and Johanan and all the other proud men said to Jeremiah, you lie. The Lord our God hasn't forbidden us to go to Egypt. Barak, son of Neriah, has convinced you to say this because he wants us to stay here and be killed by the Babylonians or be carried off into exile. What kind of weird conspiracy talk is that? Really? What? You're lying. They're trying to get us. He wants us to die. We saw this last week when the nation was still intact, and we're seeing it now. It's not that they disagreed with what was the best policy for the nation or for the rest of the nation. It wasn't that they disagreed about what was best to do. It's that if you are on the other side of the aisle about what I think is best, if I think you're wrong and I'm right, you're not just wrong, you're evil. You have bad motives, because if you were right, you'd see it my way. So I'm going to demonize. I'm not going to have a dialogue and wrestle down the best ideas. We do this all the time in American politics, right? I'm not going to wrestle down best ideas, think the best of each other, try to figure it out, have disagreements, and believe. No, I'm going to demonize you, you know? Like he does it to Jeremiah. You're lying. Also, you're deceived. You know, we do that. I see that in politics, haven't you? The other side are bad. Their leadership is both evil masterminds and also incompetent morons. Which is it? It's both, because I hate them, you know? We like to dramatize our issues and not just find common ground. And they're like, Jeremiah, you are trying to, you're trying to kill us all. You're lying to us, or you're tricked by someone who's trying to get us all killed. Nothing other than you're wrong and we're right. So, Johanan and the other military leaders took all the people, and all the people refused to obey the Lord's command to stay in Judah. Johanan and the other leaders took with them all the people who had returned from the nearby countries to which they had fled. Because basically people came back and they're like, we're going to Egypt, guys, get on the bus. We don't want to go to Egypt. No, we're going to Egypt. What are you going to do? If the military families are going to go to Egypt, you're going to be there unprotected. You're already scared. And they're not really giving you a choice. Let's go. So they're going to leave for Egypt. In the crowd were men, women, and children, the king's daughters, and all those whom Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, had left with Gedaliah. Also, the prophet Jeremiah and Barak were also included. Interesting, isn't it? Like, you guys can't even stay here. You should have gone to Babylon, Jeremiah. They would have made you a celebrity there, but instead you stayed here, and now you're getting dragged west. You just should have gone. Jeremiah had the worst, like, God, am I following you? Because nothing is going, it's just always rejection and false accusation and mistreatment, and now he's being dragged to Egypt with these other idiots, you know? So he's not happy. And we won't get into the rest of the story there, but I'll just tell you a couple details. When they get to Egypt, they do a lot of crazy stuff. They begin to worship another deity they called the Queen of Heaven, which many believed was a consort of Yahweh, just a very weird religious belief. But anyhow, it was very common in that version of the Yahwism. They began to do that. Jeremiah tried to warn them, don't do that. He got mocked for that by the women of the country. On top of that, he said, when they got to Egypt, I'm going to build a little monument here to let you know that in this very spot that you've run to, the Babylonians will come and conquer you here. What you tried to avoid at home is going to happen here anyhow, so that was a dumb move. And that's it. We don't know what happens after that. Jeremiah just eventually finishes his memoirs and dies. What a great story. But again, we said it last week, I'll say it now. Nobody wants to be Jeremiah. But I'm sure I'm glad there was a Jeremiah. We're always thankful there's people like him. And boy, I tell you, looking back in his past, he didn't feel like he got much done or didn't accomplish much. Didn't have much of a payoff for his life's calling. And yet, 2,500 years later, we read the story and we're like, kudos to that man. I think today in eternity, he's okay. But in his life down here, it probably felt like a waste. If you ever felt like you were doing something for the Lord and it was all in vain, the final story's not written yet. Don't lose hope. Well, we're going to finish our time with Jeremiah there. But I do want to spend the rest of the time, the last few minutes we have together, talking about a separate book that Jeremiah wrote, so we can kind of wrap that up as well. Jeremiah wrote two books. One was his own memoir called The Book of Jeremiah. It's huge. And then the other one is a book of, it's called Lamentations, or the Lamentations of Jeremiah. It's only five chapters long, though some of them are very long chapters, but it's just a book. It's like a collection of sad poetry or sad songs. So I call it a country music collection right there, you know. Lost everything, it's all gone, woe is me. Anyhow, so he has this collection of sad songs or poetry called the Book of Lamentations. And I'm going to glance at it with you for a few minutes so that you know what's in it and we can learn one lesson from it, hopefully, or two. It begins in Lamentations chapter 1, verse 1. It says, Jerusalem, once so full of people, is now deserted. She who was once great among the nations now sits alone like a widow. Once the queen of all the earth, she is now a slave. The whole book is just a sad lament. In fact, Jeremiah is either writing as if he's personifying Jerusalem, bewailing her own misfortune, or as a citizen himself grieving the loss of his own nation and his own people. And verse 12 is so good. Verse 12, he says, does it mean nothing to you, all you who pass by? Look around and see if there is any suffering like mine, which the Lord brought on me when he erupted in fierce anger. That's a powerful little verse. I don't want to rush past it. He says, does anyone care? Is it nothing to you? Does it mean nothing to you, all you who pass by? Like there's no grief like mine. What he was saying is this. From where I sit in my own grief and sorrow, I feel like no one gets me. Have you ever been through grief? This is a truth for all of us, by the way. If you've ever gone through deep loss or devastating grief, you know how true this is. It always feels like no one else fully feels what you're feeling because they can't, because their vantage point of your grief is different than your vantage point of your grief. People might come up and care. They might be nearby. They might be passing by. They might have empathy, but it's not their pain. They might show up to the hospital. They might visit you at the memorial service. They might bring some groceries to your house and give you a little help. But they're going to go about their way. They have their own life. They intersect with you daily at work or once a week, maybe in your faith community. And they care. They might care. Some people don't even care, actually. Some people are only worried about, oh, I hope that doesn't happen to me. But others truly care. Some people are very empathetic. But even the most empathetic people have their own lives. They just intersect with your grief at different moments, and they care about you. But you always, there's a certain loneliness. We all feel it, don't we? There's a certain loneliness in grief. Like nobody can feel exactly what I'm feeling. No one can appreciate, not even the people pretty close to me. And the faster we understand that, the faster we won't expect things from people that they can't offer us because they don't have our vantage point. We got to walk through that. And it's hard to walk through difficult time. Hard to believe it'll ever get better. It does, but it doesn't feel like it will. And it takes time, doesn't it? Grief is a funny thing. We want to rush through it, but it's like getting a physical injury. When your body gets injured, it has to heal, and it takes time to heal. Healthy healing takes time, but it's not always pleasant. And sometimes when we go through emotional pain or heartache, we want it to be over. But that's not always healthy. And sometimes you just have to live in a space you don't want to live in to emerge in time in a more healthy way. But when you're going through it, it can feel lonely at times. And Jeremiah is expressing the loneliness of people who care, but they're also just kind of intersecting along the way, and they don't feel it as deep as the one who is grieving feels it. And we can all understand that and need to remember that about ourselves and about each other. If you read this whole book of Lamentations, it's all tragic. In fact, it'd be very easy to finish the book and say, what hope is there? What hope is there in grief? Like, how do you even carry on during the worst of times? And Jeremiah gives us one little glimpse right in the middle of this book, right in chapter 3. He gives us a little glimpse into his path forward through crushing, devastating grief. And maybe it will help you too. Let's read about it together. In Lamentations 3:19, Jeremiah laments. He says, the thought of my suffering and homelessness is bitter beyond words. I will never forget this awful time as I grieve over my loss. It might get a little less frequent, a little less intense, but it will always be a part of my story. It'll always be with me. I'll never get over it. Like, how do you come through a grief and a loss like this and be okay? How do you move past such devastating pain? And Jeremiah says something next that should give us a little understanding of his perspective. He said, "Yet I still dare to hope." When I remember this, well, what's this? I need to know. Because whatever this is has caused him to hope, to have the audacity of hope, to dare to hope. Like, what is this thing that when you remember this, you still, through all this heartache, dare to hope? And Jeremiah tells us in verse 22, he says, "The faithful love of the Lord never ends. His mercies never cease." You're like, Jeremiah, are you kidding me? Look around you. Does this look like God's love? What's happened? Does this look like God is very loving? And Jeremiah is like, oh, no, no, no. Don't misassign these heartaches as a case or an indictment against God's love. That's not what this is about. God is love. This is about our own decisions. Have you not been reading the story? We've bullheadedly done this to ourselves. That's not God's fault. Look, God is love, right? Like, I say this all the time to you, that God is love, that God, in a macro level, God in love created everything. He created the world. He created you and me and gave us life and placed us in this world. He made this great experiment of humanity, this sandbox in which we live with natural laws and spiritual laws. He's given us this gift out of love, and God has given all of us something else in love. He's given us the freedom to choose. And that's a gift, isn't it? Because no one wants to be a puppet on a string. We all like the freedom to have autonomy, but we don't always like the fallout. We want freedom to choose, but also freedom from consequences, from choices, but it doesn't work that way. And yet God gets blamed a lot by people who say, tells us how to live. Let me live my own life and butt out. You're too authoritarian. Also, you're too permissive because look what you let happen here, God. Like, which is it? I don't know. I just want to be mad at God, you know? And so God gets the blame. But God in love gave us life, and God in love gave us freedom to make choices. But choices have outcomes. Decisions have consequences. And so Jeremiah's like, look, we did this, man. That's not about God's love. We're experiencing what happens when people do things. All of us live through the pain of what people do, right? Things that we do to ourselves, things that people around us do that affects us, people that who came before us do that affects us. Some of us live in poverty or wealth because our ancestors set us up, good or bad. Some people live in countries or states or areas that are better off or worse off because of people before them who paved the way for good or bad. Sometimes people around us affect us, and we affect ourselves, we affect others. That's just the gift of humanity in life. And God steps in, and God cares, and God loves us. His love is not in question. But we do get to live in this grand experiment of humanity and play in the sandbox that God created with the rules he gave us for laws, natural and physical and spiritual, and realize that our choices and our freedoms bring outcomes. Does God care? Of course he cares. He cares like you moms and dads. We care when our grown kids make their choices that we may not agree with. Oh, God forbid. Like, my kids are doing things I don't agree with. Did you do things that your parents didn't agree with? That was different. Okay, fine. But anyhow, sometimes they make bad choices, right? Like, they're stupid. Were you ever stupid? Okay, never mind. But, you know, they're like, I worry for their choices. Okay, here's the thing. What do? We grieve, but we still love them, right? We're there as much as we can be. We cheer when they do well, we hurt when they do poorly, and we love them no matter what. And God comes along and says, I've given you life, I've let you choose. I grieve when you make a mess. I grieve when you're affected by someone else's mess. I love you. And Jeremiah says, don't blame God that he's unloving because of what we chose to do as a nation. And I didn't, Jeremiah's like, I said the right message, but I'm experiencing the fallout. But God still is love. God is still faithful. His faithful love never ends. His mercies never cease. In fact, he goes on to say this. He says, great is his faithfulness. I love that. Great is his faithfulness. His mercies begin afresh each morning. What he's saying is this. He's like, every day. Now, what does that mean, his mercies begin afresh each morning? Well, it probably means a couple things. It could mean that every day I wake up, I have a new day of life. That's cool. That's a mercy. It could mean that every day is a brand new page, a blank canvas to be written on still. It's a fresh mercy each morning. Or perhaps it means something else that I'll point out in just a moment here. But he says, great is his faithfulness. Verse 24, I say to myself, the Lord is my inheritance. Inheritance is something you get, maybe someday, maybe now, maybe a little bit now in sections, but it's okay. I have the Lord. Therefore, I will hope. There's that word hope again. I will dare to hope in him despite the terrible book of Lamentations that I'm grieving my pain and my loss. The Lord is good to those who depend on him, to those who search for him. And then he closes this section, verse 26, by saying, so it is good to wait quietly for salvation from the Lord. Wait quietly. Does that mean shut your mouth? No. Well, maybe. Maybe sometimes it does, yeah. But no, it means be still and know that he is Lord. It means rest and wait. Isn't it hard to wait? We don't like to wait. Who waits anymore? You know, I'm on my express breakfast. My Pop-Tarts take too long in the toaster, so I microwave them, you know? I mean, you know, wait. I don't want to wait. I don't want to go through grief and wait for it to get better. It's good to wait quietly for salvation from the Lord. That's a big deal. David, who came hundreds of years before Jeremiah, said the same thing, didn't he? David once said, I would have fainted, except I believed that I would see God's goodness in my life someday, even though it's not good right now. And then David wrote, wait on the Lord. Be of good courage, and he will strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, in the Lord. And Jeremiah, maybe he remembers those words hundreds of years later in his own grief, and he says, it's good to wait quietly for salvation from the Lord. Now we're going to move past Jeremiah. We're moving towards the very back few weeks of our Old Testament study. But as we end today, I want to give you a thought for what Jeremiah is saying here. And I'm going to put it in terms of I and me instead of you so it doesn't sound as preachy. Because maybe you're going through something hard today and you are struggling and you don't need me to, you know, the last thing, if you're going through pain, if I'm talking to you individually, you don't want someone to come up to you and say, this is how you should feel about your suffering. It's like, oh, thanks a lot. That helps, right? People do that. It's like, I don't need that. People do that to all of us, don't they? They're like, here's how you should feel. If you're going through a tough time, I don't have a sermon for you. One-on-one, if you're going through a tough time and I'm talking to you and I'm hearing how upset you are, I'm likely going to say, I hear you. If I went through what you went through, I'd feel the same way you feel. I understand. But I'm talking right now to the collective, right? To those in the room and online or watching later or listening later. I'm talking to the collective. I'm talking to people who have already gone through terrible grief and have experienced what I'm talking about today. Or those who are going through it right now but are ready to hear what we're saying. Or maybe I'm speaking to somebody who's going to need this someday and need to log it away when it counts. And that is that when you or I go through terrible times and we're grieving like the book of Lamentations, it's important to remember this, that I don't have to wonder about God. I may just need to wait. It's hard to wait. But God is good, and God loves, and God is there, and God cares. I may just need to wait. That's hard to do. That's the other part of his mercies are fresh each morning. Not just that it's a new day, I've got another day of life, it's a blank canvas. I think part of the fresh mercies of a brand new day is the reminder that though it was dark all night long because he could not see the sun at night, in the morning, the light shines again. Every single day reminds us that darkness does not last forever. And yes, it gets dark at times. Every day of our lives, it gets dark for hours, doesn't it? And so every morning, I'm reminded that as dark as it got during the night, and though I could not see the sun was there. It was hidden from my view, from where I was at. But the next morning, the light shines through. Darkness does not last forever. That's a reminder, that's a mercy. Every morning tells me, this too shall pass. The sun will shine again. I grew up, my mom, when I was growing up, was very, always musical. She'd sing songs to us, wrote little choruses and ditties when we were babies and sang, and always musical. That's probably why I love music. And I remember a chorus I used to hear growing up from her: "The sun will shine again, the sun will shine. As sure as light brings day, joy will be mine. Dark clouds may hover, but soon will pass away. The sun will shine again and bring a bright new day." And I know that's hard to hope for when you're in the thick of it. But every morning reminds us that the night only lasts so long. The light shines again. Better days are ahead. And I hope that that will allow you to dare to hope and remind us all that we don't have to wonder about God. When things are tough, when things are dark, we may just need to wait on the Lord. And He will strengthen our hearts. Let's pray.